I used to think there was no one else. Felt the cold and rain.
Good morning. Good morning. This is John Neeters here as your host of The Balancing Point. I want to welcome you to another special edition of The Balancing Point. The Monday shows, which are a gift from KEST, allowing us to come on and do some more fun things, I do an hour of a very particular topic. And today the topic is going to be mental-emotional disorders. Okay, mental-emotional disorders. Or what the Chinese might call essence-spirit diseases. I think the last show might have been, I think it was the last show I did on goo disorders, which are spirit possession diseases. And there's a huge overlap in these, but this is not necessarily to the depth or to the physiological causes from a Western standpoint in these essence spirit diseases. This is really a very, very powerful way of looking at the essence and how it manifests in this apparent reality. How do we relate? How do we relate to others? How do we relate to ourselves? How do we relate to being? How do we relate to our surroundings? And so that we're looking at the essence spirit and how that works. And for better or for worse, I don't do a lot of preparation for these Monday shows, so they are fresh, but I haven't done a lot of research. And so it's mostly just extemporaneous, just talking with you about these conditions the way I might talk to one of my patients. And this was prompted because of an article that came out that I read in the San Francisco Chronicle over the weekend. The title of the article is Critics' Fault: Updates to Key Manual. And that really prompted me to really reconsider what's happening in the field of psychiatry and in the field of psychology and the road that we're heading down. And I typically will talk about, the road we're headed down, which is not a particularly good road or a healthy road, in terms of the physiological manifestations, pain, arthritis, heart disease, diabetes. Today I'm going to talk about that same heading down this path, down this road, where it affects what we in the West call mental-emotional disorders or psychiatric disorders. Again, psychiatric is such a strong word, and it has such pejorative meaning, and that's really one of the issues I want to talk about today. In Chinese medicine, at least pre-Maoist, after Mao, nobody got sick. Right, that was that you were living in the ideal worker's state, and nobody was allowed to have mental emotional disorders. You were sent off for retraining. Fortunately, has come back around to people actually being able to get treatment for disorders. So, I want to talk a little bit about this in general. I want to talk about the minor to major uproar that's occurring over the DSM-4. And the DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And what's happening is there is a movement to write a DSM-5. So this is where some of the uproar is occurring in Western biomedicine, and it's also something that everybody should be concerned with. It will either affect you directly or indirectly. There's really not much of any way around it unless you're living up on a mountaintop somewhere and you're not collecting money from any place and you're not paying taxes. So if you're one of those people, you're probably not listening to the show. But everybody else is affected by these decisions, and we often don't realize how big the effect is. On a physiological side, I've spoken many times about what happens when supplements become pharmaceuticalized, when they become approved by the FDA. And I've certainly talked ad nauseum at length about the horrific, horrific things that are coming down the pike in terms of control of our supplements. But if we take just the example of Lovaza, the fish oil that was approved by the FDA, I am now seeing, and the same doctors who have ridiculed me for the last 10 or 12 years, because I live in a moderately small community, and I would recommend these things for people, and they go to their doctors, and their doctors would literally laugh out loud at them for taking vitamin D and fish oil and probiotics and things like that, and the doctors literally, I know them, would laugh and say, oh, you don't need that stuff. Now those very same doctors are prescribing these products. Why? Because some company has spent the hundreds of thousands of dollars to get a patent on, not on the, like on fish oil, they can't patent fish oil, but they can patent methods for purification or methods for changing it, really in many cases making products artificial, like artificial vitamin D, which is worse than worthless. It increases the death rate versus real vitamin D, which you cannot patent and saves lives. You know, by the way, on that, on those particular studies, there was a large study that was just released, very large study. I've not seen it posted anywhere on any mainstream publication of any type. This study showed that people taking artificial vitamin E, died at an overall mortality rate of 2% higher. Now, that's bad. That's really bad, 2% higher mortality rate. People versus people taking actual, right, mixed tocopherols, maybe tocotrienols, but a mixture of vitamin E's had a lowered mortality rate of 6%. So the difference between artificial and real vitamin E is an overall mortality rate of 8%. 8%. So it begs the question, why do they continue to use artificial vitamin E in all their studies? And that's one just for you to sit with and question. Why would that be the case? And you'll come down to the answer in a while. In fact, we're going to talk about the answer to that question and how it determines our psychiatric and psychological care also. I'm going to quote from Aaron Alday, who is a staff writer for the Chronicle. The, quote, Bible of American Psychiatry, a manual of mental health used around the world by doctors, consumers, I doubt that, and insurance providers, has come under fire from a growing group of psychologists who worry that proposed revisions will feed into a culture of overdiagnosing and overtreating otherwise healthy people. Now, I want you to... One of the fascinating things about that is we're not talking about acupuncturists rebelling against this. We're not talking about the man on the street rebelling against this. We're talking about the very people that treat this, these disorders are rebelling against. Now, these are people who actually stand to lose money, right? Because less, fewer people might be diagnosed with the old manuals. So they're saying they're worried about overdiagnosing and overtreating otherwise healthy people. The DSMs are always debated. You know, I've spoken about some of the insane diagnostic criteria in my mind that showed up in the DSM-4, but the DSM-5 is going to go even farther. President of Saybrook Institute, psychiatric training program, psychological training program, and he says, quote, when he saw in the DSM-5 that there was going to be a push in the direction of a more medical, less holistic way of doing things, we felt we should take a stand. And so they now have 7,000, and Saybrook is in San Francisco, it's a university, 7,000 signatures that they've gathered against the DSM-5 and where they're going. And one of the things that's occurred is, and something that actually has, in a way, a good turn, and that is that there's been an increasingly pointing to biological causes for a wide variety of mental health conditions. Well, that could be good. The Chinese feel that way, that your what's happening in your body, the biology, the pathology, et cetera, in the body, determines your mental emotional state in large measure. Not 100%, but in large measure, you can that can be controlled by changing the biology, the physiology, removing the pathologies from the body. And so in biomedicine, they're moving more toward that. Now, that could be good, except for that one thing that always gets in the way of our culture, and that's money in the hands of a very few people who spend that money to support their own causes at the to the detriment of the population as a whole. They are, you know, they are basically spending the money so that they can make more money. And that's certainly what we have happening here, in my opinion. Given that they're acknowledging that there are more biological causes, we could look to diet, which has been shown to have a huge influence on so-called psychiatric and psychological disorders. We could look at supplements, certainly look at herbs. There are a lot of things, acupuncture, anything that changes the biology and the physiology can change that mental and emotional state. So this could be a really positive thing. However, of course, what is happening is that these particular disorders are being directed toward particular pharmacological treatments, right? So you go here that we have behavior, you can plug it into your computer. We have behaviors A, B, and C. Then we define that condition as X, and you give drug Y or maybe drug Z. And it's just a flow chart going through to a drug treatment, rather than toward talk therapy, rather than toward acupuncture, rather than toward herbal medicine, rather than toward exercise, which is the number one treatment, by the way, for all psychological disorders. If you put exercise and diet up against drugs, it's not even in the same ballpark. Now, I'm talking for mild to moderate disorders, for very, very severe disorders, and please, please, absolutely, I never advocate against drugs. I advocate just as Mark Shulman, the president of Saybrook, did against overdiagnosing, overtreating, overdrugging. There are certainly people that benefit from psychiatric drugs. There's no doubt about that in my mind. However, if we would start out with the milder forms of treatment, we would save trillions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of useful lives by keeping people not drugged out. So as we're looking here, we're seeing more and more pharmacological answers and drugs being used to solve mental health problems that aren't even problems at all. So I'm quoting from that same article, and that's what these 7,000 people are saying, is you made it up, dude. These aren't even mental, emotional, psychiatric disorders. These are life, and you have drugs that are being prescribed for them. Now, take this into consideration. In 2010, one out of every five American adults was using some type of mental health medication. One in five. Now, 50 years ago, even 20 years ago, people would never even admit, because there was such a stigma, and I'm glad the stigma's gone, that they were using these disorders. But why is it that now 20% of the population, quote, needs, end quote, to be on psychological and psychiatric drugs, actually. And that's a 22% increase over the last decade. So we've suddenly gotten 22% less able to run our lives without resorting to legal drugs. Okay. And so what happens is we're seeing less and less therapy, less and less talk therapy, and more drugs, because drugs are cheaper than talk therapy, and drugs make more money for the people that are getting incredibly wealthy on this. You know, if you go to a psychologist, the psychologist, you know, makes their living doing, you know, doing this talk therapy. They spend an hour typically with a patient, and that's more expensive than giving someone a drug that they can take once a day. Of course, with the drug, all the profit, that's not quite true, most of the profit goes through to the drug companies. And I say not all, because, you know, we have the case where in states that require that doctors report the money that they get from drug companies, in 2009, I think it was, the person who received the most money from drug companies was a psychiatrist in a North Midwest state who got over $600,000 from drug companies. $600,000. And, of course, he's one of the big proponents of drugging our children and drugging other people. So this is really a big deal. Now, when we're looking at overdiagnosing, in the same article, they're talking about things like, I'll quote again, grief after the death of a loved one, for example, may be included under the diagnosis of major depressive disorder. Okay? That means a person's grief could be labeled a pathological disorder and not a normal human experience. And that's what we're seeing. Things that have been normal since the beginning of recorded history. You know, you have good days and bad days, you know. You have grief over the passing of a loved one. These are considered normal things. Now, it's being called a major psychiatric depressive disorder. Now, there are a couple things about that. One, it means that you will get drugs, and you may not get the talk therapy and the other things that you need to actually help you work through that. It also means that that's going to go in your medical records. And those medical records can be accessed by people you would not believe. And let me digress a moment. Some of the most amazing things in U.S. history have happened and are happening over the last few years. We have seen a relabeling, a complete relabeling of freedom of speech, for example. We now have, if you've ever looked at the FEMA guidelines, the Federal Emergency Management Act, which, you know, people think of, yeah, they're the people that come, you know, clean up after floods and do that stuff. Well, that's only a tiny bit of what they do. If you've ever read their act, they have the right to institute martial law. So right now, with the Occupy Oakland and the Occupy wherever else, Occupy Wall Street demonstrations that are going on, by law, they could declare martial law because there are simultaneous demonstrations going on in two or more cities of the U.S., and that's all it takes to trigger that. So we really have lost our right to free assembly. You know, whether you agree with what these people are, you know, like with Occupy Oakland, whether you agree with their, I think most people probably agree with what they're saying. You may or may not agree with their tactics. However, really, those people can be arrested at any moment, no matter how they demonstrate, according to the FEMA Act. All you have to do is trigger that in. Now, at the same time, it was signed into law last year, Kathleen Sebelius, and then the governor of California, I guess that was 2 years ago, with the influenza, quote, epidemic, end quote, that never happened, but it was called an epidemic because they changed the definition of an epidemic. So when that was signed into law, every citizen of the United States could be held until they agreed to take a vaccine, or they could be put in an internment camp for the rest of their lives, or until they agreed to take the vaccine, or until the epidemic status was lifted. That was signed. It's been in law for a while, but the triggering mechanism happened so that was actually signed into law. And at any moment, all it took was one phone call, and that would occur. So you lost the right. Believe me, you completely lost the right to control what is injected into your body. You can be locked up for life if you refuse to take a vaccine that has never been tested, never been proven. And if it damages you, you cannot sue the manufacturers of that vaccine, nor can you sue the government which has forced you to take it. That's a pretty big loss of liberty. At the same time, and this is really more to my point, the Supreme Court has now held, a little while back, that actually corporations are truly people. They are to be considered people and treated as people, which means they have the right to free speech. So now corporations have the right to free speech, even though individuals basically don't anymore. And they also upheld that money is the same as speech. Right, so you can put your money behind any cause you want, and that is protected by the amendments for free speech. So now money equals speech, corporations equal people. What does that mean? It means that corporations can contribute as much money as they want, because they're protected by free speech, to candidates for election. Wow. That just cost you many trillions of dollars as a group, and it has cost every one of you amazing amounts of money. Because what that means is, with that power to even further, even more than historically has been the case, control our legislatures, you know where the lawmaking is going to go. We will see a further support of pharmaceutical systems at the expense of all forms of natural treatment. We're already seeing that. This is not a guess. This has all already happened. And so how does that affect us? Well, in the case of the DSM-4, most of these decisions are not actually made by doctors. And so, for example, who gets covered and who doesn't get covered for an illness is really largely up to insurance companies. So we're now seeing that there's this, what had been a slow erosion is now a tectonic shift into mental illness. And why am I bringing this up? Because you will be caught up in this system. Someone you love will be caught up in this system. And you need to know how to treat yourself and or find reasonable care for the people around you. Now, I was mentioning grief being one of the new things that they're going to change in the DSM. Another one, and again, I'm going to quote from this article by Aaron Alday, another diagnosis, dysphoric mood dysregulation disorder. Now, doesn't that sound horrible? I mean, who would want to have dysphoric mood dysregulation disorder? Oh, my God, that must be a horrible thing. Well, actually, what that is temper tantrums. So if a child throws a temper tantrum, sorry, parents, some of you will not like this. My experience is that 90% at least of temper tantrums are due to parenting. Flat out, no doubt about it. And I say that because kids don't act out with me. They know that's not appropriate. I treat them as human beings. I tell them what I expect. And almost always, I mean, there are some exceptions. I get some kids who are, you know, on autism spectrum disorder, and they really can't control themselves. But other than that, kids always are respectful in my office until their parents show up. And then guess what? They show symptoms of dysphoric mood dysregulation disorder, temper tantrums. Wow. I'm sure you understand. Then the treatment for that is a drug, because we don't want your kid to have temper tantrums. We don't want you to parent them differently, or maybe even get psychological help or parenting training to help deal with that. We are going to drug those kids. Now, if this doesn't scare you, I don't know what does, because we have two-year-olds that are going on powerful psychoactive drugs. What is their life going to be like? Now, you tell me, how much testing has been done on these drugs in two-year-olds? And the answer is almost zero. What is the effect going to be on these kids in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? Nobody has any idea. Well, I have an idea, but nobody's done any research on it. If you're interested in this topic, by the way, I would check out Eric Maisel, M-A-I-S-E-L. I ran across him when I was you know, looking through some things this morning, the American Psychological Association, the Society of Humanistic Psychology, he had several articles. And so he goes even further in this, looking at bereavement as a mood disorder. He says mild forgetfulness will become a mental disorder, which is mild neurocognitive disorder. Now, this is going to go in your permanent record. All insurance companies, marketing companies, will have and do have access to your medical information. Okay? That's what happened with the HIPAA Act. It was supposed to protect your records. It opened it up basically to everybody. And also, and by the way, the marketing companies, it's under the Free Speech Act, that they can get your information and utilize that. We have credit scoring companies now doing medical scoring, the FICO scores, to make sure or to grade you on how well you take your medications. And once you get a diagnosis on a DSM, that's going to stick with you. So go try to get a job, right? When you have a mild neurocognitive disorder or disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, go out and try to get a job. Yeah, so mild forgetfulness, temper tantrums. Oh, here's one I loved. Preferring one of your parents to the other. Okay, so and every child does this. At different points in their life, they want to be with their mom, then they want to be with their dad, then they want to be with their mom. We call this healthy growth. Okay, little boys, when they're up to 5 to 7 years old, want to be mostly with their mothers. After that age, it's most healthy if they want to be with their fathers. And then they go back and forth as their hormones kick in with different preferences. That is called normal. Okay, that's the disease, normal. And that will be called parental alienation disorder. So if you prefer one parent, the one who gives you lots of candy and lets you do whatever you want, over another parent who holds you accountable and doesn't let you throw temper tantrums, then that's parental alienation disorder. Again, and so we have these huge numbers of new diagnoses. We have apathy disorder. You don't like doing your work. You don't want to go to work. You don't really care. You don't really give a darn about your job. Boy, you have a psychiatric condition called apathy disorder. You like talking on, you spend a lot of time on Facebook. You have internet addiction disorder. These are things that are actually, that they're proposed as additions to the DSM-5. Internet addiction disorder. Okay, now there is no basis or virtually no basis for any of those things in the empirical literature. It's just a way to categorize people, pigeonhole them in ways that are wholly inaccurate, and give them drugs. Kind of cool, huh? So anyway, check out Maisel. He's got a couple of nice little articles in there. Now, they redo the DSM. Again, we're in the fifth change. They do it, that's in the last 60 years, and that goes back into the early 1920s. Actually, in the 1840s, there was one category, and it was called idiocy/insanity. So in 1840, there's only one mental disorder you could have, and that was idiocy insanity. And then when they got up to 1917, they came up with a whole bunch of new things. And then around World War II, and this I thought was a good change, there were a lot of men and women coming out of World War II with severe psychological and psychiatric disorders, even from, you know, being in the war, post-traumatic stress disorder types of things, to alienation problems. You know, I know my mom had some mental emotional issues, but a lot of it came out of her deep, deep fear. You know, she grew up in a family of 13 children. She married my dad. My dad immediately went off to war in Korea. I was born. She was pulled away from her family, relocated to a city where she knew nobody. She had a baby that she couldn't really support. I mean, on the few dollars my dad sent home from Korea, you know, she was barely able to do it. And then they moved from, when he was discharged, from military post to military post, and she was very afraid. Well, it's pretty reasonable. All of her support systems have been completely destroyed. But she was given a psychiatric tag. I mean, I don't know if it was valid or not. I have no idea. I was a baby. But which then she carried for the rest of her life. Now, I saw her go through periods of deep, deep depression and psychological disorder. But I also saw when she came to live with me and we got her off the 40 pills a day she was taking, got her down to one, that she was lucid and happy and loving her life. So I know that the happy side was possible without the drugs. So anyway, we've gone through this DSM process, and, you know, there are some good things. It does allow people to get treatment and medication under our insurance system. So we always have to use that caveat. Given the system that we have, which is pretty horrible, this is probably a good thing. We always need to throw that in there. There are a variety of what they call axes. Axis 1 is clinical disorders. Those are the major mental disorders and learning disorders or substance abuse. Axis 2 are personality disorders, intellectual disabilities. Autism, I think, was an Axis 2. It'll now go up to an Axis 1, which is, I think, reasonable. Axis 3 is acute medical conditions and physical disorders. Axis 4 are psychosocial and environmental factors contributing to disorder. And Axis 5, global assessment of functioning or children's global assessment scale. So this is how they categorize your children. The validity and reliability of these has always been in question. Going back to the Rosenhand experiment in the 1970s, where they took patients and reevaluated them, and different doctors came up with wildly different evaluations, from either perfectly normal to relatively moderate psychoses. So, it really, they're not. This is not really science. And so that's one of the problems that we see here in this DSM is who's making it up and who does it apply to? And one of the issues there is cultural bias, right? Different cultures have different ways of looking at interrelationships between human beings. Some cultures are very, very, like I was talking to someone from New Zealand, and he said, you didn't get invited to people's homes until you knew them for a very long time. Nobody talked about their personal lives. Everything was, you know, very, very private. You look at what we do on Facebook, and, you know, you've got, whoa, scary stuff on there. You know, how many times did you poop today? You know, I'm going to tweet you about what I'm having for dinner right now and where I'm going to go at 7 o'clock. So we've pretty much given up privacy in our culture. And so who's correct? What's the norm around that? What's the norm around grief and bereavement? And so that's one of the big issues looking at the DSM manuals is that they're very biased. They're very culturally biased. And so if you aren't of the dominant paradigm, then your behaviors may be seen as aberrant. Here's a great example, a really simple example. I lived in a house about 20 years ago, almost 30 years ago, and there were two houses on one lot, and the family beside me was Laotian, I believe. Delightful family, just loved them. And one day I was coming out the door, and one of the little kids was running with five or six of his siblings, and he fell and pretty hard and skinned his knee. And they all ran up around him and pointed at him and started laughing. And this little boy laid on the ground, and for a second it looked like he was going to cry, and then he started laughing with them. They all started laughing together. This is so funny. And I was furious. Really, I wanted to go out and yell at these kids, but fortunately I didn't. I just watched. And they all got up and ran off and played again. Now, if that happened in our culture, right, you're running on the playground, one kid falls down, skins his knee, and five other kids come up and start laughing at him, those kids are going to the principal's office. They may be called in for psychiatric counseling for their taunting, bullying behavior. But in his culture, that was the cultural norm, and there are many good reasons for that. You know, if you're chasing, you know, if you're hunting, if you're running away from an enemy and you fall down and you lay there and cry, well, you might get killed or at least not catch dinner. But if you immediately hop up and start laughing, that's a real survival mechanism. But in our culture, those kids can end up in psychiatric care. So again, these cultural differences are very difficult to structure into a psychiatric manual. And then, of course, we have the big objection. And here's a quote in 2005. The president of the American Psychiatric Association, a guy named Steven Sharfstein, he released a statement in which he conceded. Now, these are the very psychiatrists that are doing this. He conceded that psychiatrists had, quote, allowed the biosocial model to become the bio-bio-bio model. And what that means is it was now to be treated with drugs. Okay, so that's what we're dealing with. Now, from a Chinese medical standpoint, we know that it's biological. We've known that for several thousand years. These conditions have been very well diagnosed. We go back to the Huang Di Nei Jing, the Yellow Emperor's classic, and I pulled out the Huang Di here, and it says, in Chapter 30 of the Su Wen, this is Simple Questions. And the fun thing to me about these early writings is they're done in question and answer format. So Huang Di, this is the emperor, says, I've observed that in severe cases of Yang Ming disorder, that's a particular type of heat disorder, a person can become delirious to the point of running around naked, talking loudly, and not consuming food for several days. At the same time, these patients are able to climb great heights and perform unusual feats, things they cannot do under normal circumstances. Why is this? And Shibo answers, the four extremities contain an abundance of yang qi, and the yang ming channels are the large intestine and small channels. And we say in Chinese medicine they have more qi and more blood. And so these are the channels that are always safe to treat, or almost always safe to treat, because there's lots of blood and lots of qi that you can move to create functionality throughout the body without overly depleting the patient. Now, when these become replete or excess to a really significant level, then you can see these disorders. The four extremities contain an abundance of yang qi. When there's a repletion of yang in the channels, great stamina results, right? There's more energy. Thus, the person is capable of physically overachieving it. Wang Di asks, why is it that they like to run around naked? Qibo answers, it is not that they like to do so, but rather that they're feverish and very hot. They dislike covering themselves and aggravating the heat. What about the behavior of cursing at people, singing and talking loudly? Qibo replies, when yang evils are replete, they harass the spirit and muddle the senses. Therefore, these people appear crazy and unreasonable and lose their senses of norm and appetite. Now, this is clearly describing some manic condition, right? So it might be, what we used to call manic depressive. Now we would call bipolar disorder, and this would be the manic phase. The yang ming is replete, and it's just gone wild. But the interesting thing is there were treatments for this condition. There still are treatments for this condition in Chinese medicine. Now, realistically, if I have a patient come in with severe bipolar disorder, the depressive part's pretty easy to treat. The manic part can sneak up on you, and I prefer that patients usually, stay on their drugs. As Gordon Fung and a psychiatrist who taught my psychiatric module, psychiatrist from Stanford University, and Bob Flaws, the great writer on Chinese medicine, both indicated, and even citing some of the same studies, even with things like bipolar disorder, often you can prescribe about one-third to one-half of the Western pharmaceutical if you also use Chinese herbs at the same time. Now, this is a Western psychiatrist saying this and a Chinese doctor saying this. And there are many, many studies that have been done in China in particular that have shown this, that if you keep them on a steady herbal regimen, then the need for the psychiatric meds is much lower. And why is that significant? All psychiatric meds have side effects. And if you can give someone one-third the dose, your risk of side effects is cut much more than to one-third. It's much lower than that. It's up at the higher doses that you get the really severe side effects. So, again, someone on that is truly bipolar, I'm going to recommend always that they stay, that they continue to work with their doctor. However, I will treat them and have them continue to work with their doctor, and the doctor may decide to lower their medication. And that is not unusual at all. In fact, that's typical. When it comes to depression and depressive disorders, very much the same thing, although in those conditions, very often people are able to get off of their antidepressant medications. Again, those have to be weaned off with the help of the medical doctor and approval very slowly, because the patient becomes dependent on that excess serotonin in their synapses, and it takes a while to get things normalized there. Qibo and Huang Di go on much further. Actually, in the Nanjing, where they're talking about difficulty 59, it says, how can mania and withdrawal be distinguished? Huh, okay, there we got it. At the beginning, emission or outbreak of mania, there's little lying down and no hunger. One speaks of oneself as if elevated and worthy. So, grandiose thinking. And speaking, one discriminates or points out one's special intelligence, and one behaves in an arrogant and haughty way. One frenetically smiles, sings, is happy, and frenetically moves about without break. During the initial outbreak of withdrawal, the mind is not happy. One lies stiffly, staring straight ahead. The pulses of the three positions. Then he goes in how to diagnose this. So we're looking here at manic depression or bipolar disorder as diagnosed in Chinese medicine about probably 2200 to 2500 years ago. So by that time, it had already been a very well described condition. And then we go on through Zhang Zhongjing, who wrote really the Bible of Chinese herbal medicine, the Shanghan Za Bing Lun, which is the treatise on damage by cold and miscellaneous diseases. And he in there talked about conditions like vexation, agitation, running piglet qi, which is one of my favorites. I actually, one of my students was in the other day, and she got so excited. It's like, oh my God, you actually have a patient diagnosed with running piglet qi. I said, yeah, I have a few. And so let me talk about running piglet qi. Running piglet qi, now again, One of the things that we get turned off by, or easily turned off by, is our overdependence on language, as though some particular language is magical and other languages are immature. Well, give me a break. Chinese language has been around for about 2,200 to 2,500 years, and we just made up these psychological definitions in the last 100 years. Okay, none of them, you know, really were around before about 1840. So in running Piglet Chi, what happens is you get this surging up into the heart, and in some cases you can't catch the breath, and there's a kind of a sensation in the heart like it's empty or hollow. It's hard to catch the breath. There's not much chi, so there might be sort of a shortness of breath. There's vexation or even pain around the chest. Hunger, but you don't want to take in food. Sometimes there's a cold in the center of the abdomen, and that kind of causes this pain in the lower ribs, like this dragging pain. So again, these are all things that we look at with running Piglet Chi, but it also has this feeling like it runs up into your heart, and that's one of the reasons they call it running Piglet Chi. In later books, we look at the relationship of with sorrow and fear, sighing, melancholy, and really looking at that as heart and gallbladder disorders. And when we see children, for example, that have night terrors and a lot of irritability at night, and they can't, you know, they have a lot of difficulties, that's often a heart gallbladder chi issue. So there'd be irritability, there can be irascible. They're just difficult. It's hard to deal with. They may talk a lot, et cetera. They may have a little manic movements. They just can't sit still. So those are things that we look at in later versions or later texts. So again, Chinese medical psychiatry and psychology has been looked at for at least 2,500 years. If we look at the character for Gu and Gu disorders, that may go back 3,500 years. So this is very, very old stuff. They've gone back for a very long period with this. Now, for each type of disorder that you would find in Western medicine, there is not a one-to-one correspondence with a Chinese syndrome, but there's a great deal of overlap and a lot of conditions that are pretty closely tied to it. Now, one of the great things is for every single pattern in what we're going to call here mental emotional disorders or imbalances, for every single pattern, there is a Chinese medical treatment that has been devised over these thousands of years. And especially since about 220 AD with the Shanghanlun and those books, it's become really, really clear and codified. And so for every single cause or every single disorder, there is something that can be done about it. Now, the one that we talk about the most in Chinese medicine, we look at the six depressions. Let me back up. We look at former heaven endowment and post-heaven endowment. Former heaven endowment is what you're born with. So these might be genetically caused disorders from a Western pathological view. And some of those, you know, are conditions that are very, very deep. They're very genetic. The child is born with them, for example. But most are post-heaven endowment primarily, and the six depressions. And Zhu Danxi, who's the person who formulated this list, this grouping of the six depressions, he said, if the blood and qi are surging and harmonious, the tens of thousands of diseases cannot be engendered. However, if one has depression, then all the diseases can be engendered. Wow. So what we're looking at here in the West is a massive aggravation of the liver, causing liver depression, qi stagnation. Now, that's caused physiologically by what we eat. We eat foods that are very, very stagnating for the liver. They cause the liver to have to overwork. Our entire culture is based on the desire for that which we do not have, and unfulfilled desires are the major cause of liver depression. The improper movement of qi as caused through the improper coursing of the liver. And this is rampant. I'm guessing that 90% of my patients, the first diagnostic pattern that I list is liver depression, qi stagnation, and then I'll list what it's assailing. Is it causing depressive heat flaring up to vex the heart? Is it causing depletion or vacuity of blood? Is it assailing the spleen? Is it assailing the stomach? But at the core of 90%, I'm guessing, and it may be higher, of the patterns that I diagnose is liver depression, qi stagnation, by largely unfulfilled desires. And this starts in childhood. We have, I've talked about this a couple times. I actually had a parent in here, and I said, yeah, I think the problem is liver depression, qi stagnation, and unfulfilled desires. And they said, well, how could that happen? And I said, well, you're here because your child's having trouble with their tutor, and he's getting tutored so that he can get in the best preschool. And then, of course, you're going to get a tutor so they can get into the best school because you want them in these very competitive schools. And then he'll have tutors so he can get in the best high schools, and then so he can get into the best colleges, then so he can get into the best graduate programs so that he can then get into the best jobs, and then he can work his way up the job and social ladder for 60 years. I said, so this child has already been set up for 55 to 65 years of unfulfilled desires, because at every step on the rung, every single step, it's incomplete. There's always another step that has to be fulfilled, another desire, another A, another grade, another physical thing to own, and that leads to the engenderment of liver depression, qi stagnation, which is at the core, even in children, of many, they want their parents' love and affection. For example, they're being groomed to play. They're very competitive at soccer, whatever it is. And I'm not demeaning any of these activities. I'm just saying we need to understand where they lead to. Now, in Chinese medicine, there are four basic body types or constitutions, and the term is Changti, which means habitual bodily. And each of those body types is differently affected by different external social dietary factors. So each of these people will have a particular illness, a particular strength that they will tend to gravitate towards. So like, for example, the Tai Yang is this very exuberant Yang-type body type, right? These have really developed upper bodies. Their lower bodies are a little weaker. These might be, may grow up to be football players. They may be super athletes. They may be weightlifters, but they may have lower body weakness, and they tend to have a red facial complexion, and because that yang is going up. If there's too much heat, then that will harass the heart, and their heart spirit becomes disquieted. And so you see this sometimes with very athletic kids, and they're really well balanced otherwise, but then you see this red complexion, and they really have difficulty calming down. And if they then develop phlegm damp with that, then you'll start to see some pretty significant emotional disorders, because when this phlegm heat it blocks the orifices of the heart, and then you get these very erratic behaviors. And for those kids, it's very important in terms of diet. They can't eat much meat. They can't eat fried foods, fatty foods, hot foods. And as adults, they can't drink too much alcohol, or that all causes more heat. So as a parent, if you can identify and see some of these conditions or empirically test it out, then you can adjust the diet and the exercise. Now, these kids need lots and lots of exercise. Then there's a Xiao Yang body type, and that's kind of the healthy young adult one that's called maybe a mesomorph in the Western typing. And so these people tend to be relatively well yin and yang balanced, as opposed to the Tai Yang, which is way too yang, too much heat, too much energy. And the Tai Yin body type is what would typically be called in Western symptoms the endomorph. And they tend to be very heavy. Sometimes they're morbidly obese. The tissue's more flaccid, doesn't have much tone. They tend to have a kind of a pale complexion, things like that. And in these people, there's not enough yang qi to move move the dampness, so they become very phlegmatic people. And so they tend not to want to move much, and so they get a lot of... These people should not eat cold foods, right? They need to eat warm foods, they need to eat cooked foods, etc. So it's really wonderful if you can start to recognize these. The Shaoyin body type, also ectomorphic, but these are the thin... people, they tend to be nervous and restless. They're constantly fidgeting. They tend toward lack of yin as opposed to excess of yin that we'd find in the Tai Yin type. And in these people, their psychiatric illness is usually vacuity heat that'll flare up and bother their heart, and they become really disquieted. Often they also have a lot of liver depression, qi stagnation, because there's not enough blood and yin to support it and moisten it. And these people also have to definitely, and if they're kids and your family, stay away from stimulating foods and drinks. So these people cannot have hot, dry foods. And these people need a lot of meat, really. This is the thing that really will, calm them down, have them relax a little bit. And a lot of these people move toward vegetarian diets. And again, I'm not anti-vegetarian diets, but I'm just saying for this body type, the Shaoyin people, they lose it. They are like all over the place. These people need more meat, trust me, or at least something very, very grounding. If they're going to be vegetarians, they have to have lots and lots of beans, et cetera. But usually it's not enough. So everything that we see, it's related to these fundamental body types. Now, one of the things, and these external influences, that I will sometimes misspeak, I will say liver depression, qi stagnation causes this mental disorder, and that's actually a misstatement, and I try to catch myself. But liver depression, qi stagnation is the energy movement. Heart fire is the energy movement. So when you resolve the heart fire, that movement of energy ceases, and sometimes it can cease immediately. I'll have people come in that can't even hold a coherent conversation. They're so anxious and stressed out. I put them on the table, and we treat their heart fire, and they get up totally calm. So if you get rid of it, the underlying pattern, or the pattern, not the underlying pattern, the pattern, the condition can immediately change. You know, as I said before, I've had stroke patients sitting here who hadn't spoken in a very long time. I stick a needle in their hand, and the woman turned to her daughter and said, "I love you." Hadn't spoken in well over a year. So this can happen very, very quickly. Now, I will probably once again revisit this and go into some specifics of what to do for different mental emotional disorders. But it all starts with diet and exercise. Diet and exercise. Get the free movement of qi. You need to build the yin and blood and the yang through your diet. And then if that's not enough, go see an acupuncturist. And I usually say go see anybody, but for these conditions, acupuncturists are uniquely suited. That's what we do. We treat patterns. And when the patterns are treated and resolved and made harmonious, it's shocking how quickly some of these conditions can resolve. And, now most of the information on treating mental emotional disorders with Chinese medicine is in treating it with Chinese medicinals, herbal extracts. There is, however, a significant amount of literature on treating it with acupuncture, and acupuncture I love for the immediate benefit. It's immediate. You know, it will happen within half an hour to 45 minutes. We'll start seeing changes. And then I use herbs to continue that treatment going forward. So I'm about out of time here, and I kind of rambled through there, but I hope you get that you should be concerned about the new DSM-5, about the monetization of medical care, and that there are lots and lots of options that you can do yourself to stay better balanced, and there are people out here that can help you to achieve and maintain better mental and emotional balance no matter what the condition is, except for severe psychiatric disorder. But if you're depressed, if you're anxious, if you're moody, if you get angry with your husband, that's a very common disorder, these can all be treated pretty effectively with alternative forms of care. So I want to thank you. I hope you tune in on Thursday to be with me again for another edition of The Balancing Point. That's at 8 a.m. And then next week, tune in with Dave and I for an edition of The Medicine Men. And I think we're taping a couple new shows this week. And then at 9 o'clock, join me for another topical edition of The Balancing Point. So thank you. Thank you for tuning in, and be happy.